This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time, listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate what they've done for us, that we greatly appreciate their service and sacrifice. We want to make sure that price of freedom that's been paid for our sake will not be forgotten. And along the way, as we listen to these stories, we sure do learn a lot. Another way to learn, of course, is to read, and I learned a ton. And, you know, I thought I'd heard a lot of the stories over all these hundreds of veterans I've interviewed, but reading the book, The Gator Navy, The Amphibious Navy That I Knew in World War II by Victor Killingsworth, sure added a lot of perspective to my understanding. And hopefully you'll get some of that today on this program. We can't hear every story in the book because there are just too many good ones in here. So if you want to read them all, I'll tell you how to get his book, The Gator Navy, a little later on in the program. But 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California is our guest today. And you've been in Taft for most of your life, a life that you were fortunate to have after World War II. But originally from a horned toad land out in Kalinga. And tell me, when you were born on November 11th, 1920, how was it that you got the name Victor? I know you weren't part of the conversation, but you heard the story later, I'm sure.
Well, I was born on Armistice Day 1 year after World War I. So my mother felt that that was appropriate and named me Victor as a result of World War I.
That's one of the best stories I've ever heard about why someone got a name, other than, hey, it sounded good. That one actually has some story behind it. So growing up, you moved from Kalinga to Taft when you were 3 years old, and there have been a lot of stories told about that oil town in Central California. In fact, there was a movie made about high school football in Taft. Were you an athlete going to high school there?
I played tennis and basketball a little bit, but I wasn't considered a red-hot athlete.
And then junior college there, were you on the track team or something like that?
No, I was on the golf team again, and I took part in the Golden Glove boxing.
That's what I read about in here, the Golden Glove boxing. How'd you get started with boxing?
Well, I had a friend that was quite an athlete, did a lot of working out, and he was a boxer, and he said, Vic, why don't you, you're pretty good at that, why don't you try it? So I worked out with him and entered the Golden Gloves at Taft College and got knocked out in the final round, so I got a silver glove, but I didn't get the Golden Glove.
Well, that's a lot better color than most of us have when it comes to our boxing careers. Eventually, you went on to the University of California. And, you know, every veteran that I interview, there's one question that I ask of every single veteran, because everyone seems to remember something. And from reading your book, I know you have a very vivid memory about December 7th, 1941, because it changed a lot of things for you. Tell us where you were and how you found out about what happened out in Hawaii.
Well, I was going to the University of California and staying in a dormitory called Oxford Hall. I was studying for finals on Sunday morning, December the 7th. Finals were to start Monday morning, so I got up early and was studying, turned on the radio, and heard the announcement that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was some kind of a joke at first, and then I ran down the hall to my friends who lived in another room in the dorm and ran in and told them we were at war. Well, they were studying for finals. In fact, the whole dorm was quiet, and they didn't say any humor in my running in and pulling a joke on them like that. So I've turned on the radio, but they threw me out in the hall. I ran back in and turned the radio on again, and they threw me out. After about three trips being thrown out, the radio warmed up. In those days, radios had to warm up. You didn't just turn them on. And the announcement came over the radio that we were at war. And, of course, then they ran up and down the hall, and pretty soon it was bedlam in the dorm.
Wow, I can only imagine what that must have felt like and looked like. Did you have to take that final the next day?
No, I called the university the next morning to see whether we were to take finals, and they said, oh, yes, you've got to take finals. You know, Berkeley is not known for being easy. So we did take finals. I don't think it changed many grades because there was so much commotion, but we did have to take them.
And I know this might be a tough one to go back all the way back in your memory and figure what your state of mind would have been, but I'm sure you remember something. before that day, because clearly that day changed the world, it changed this country, and it would change your life. But before that happened, here you are in school at the University of California. Did you have an idea of what you were going to do after that and what your life was going to look like, what your career goals might be?
Well, while I was going to Cal, I met a gentleman by the name of Gardner Blackman, who was head of personnel for Associated Oil Company and had their main office in San Francisco. And he had offered me a job in personnel administration and said, when you get through, come and see me. We've got a job for you. Well, I changed all that, as it did for every young man trying to decide what to do. Completely changed our lives, all of us.
You worked in the shipyards there in the Bay Area real briefly. In fact, we had another veteran on recently who was working for Kaiser there, building all those Liberty ships. But you decided there were some other ships that might be in your future. What led to your decision to become a Navy man?
Well, one thing, my vision, I didn't think I'd be a pilot. I had no sense of depth, but I liked the idea of being able to see different parts of the world, and I thought Navy would do that. I did work at the Navy Yard when I got finished at Cal, and I finished in the summer, about August of 42, I guess it was, and worked for Kaiser Shipyard in building Liberty ships. I figured I could contribute some way by doing that. And then I enlisted. Well, I enlisted in the Navy in February while I was still at Cal. I did enlist then. And they allowed me to finish college. And when I finished, I told them I was ready. And they said, we're not ready. Go find a job. So that's when I worked for Kaiser. And they didn't call me until the end of November. And we were scheduled to leave on December the 3rd from San Francisco.
Can you remember what expectations you might have had, what you thought the Navy was going to be like? I'm sure what it ended up being was a lot different, but what do you think your expectations were?
Well, coming from Taft, a desert town, and the biggest boat I'd ever been in was a rowboat, I don't think I had much expectation. It was just a thing to do. I looked forward to going in the Navy, so it was a pleasure. They took 30 of us from the Bay Area. They took 15 from Cal and 15 from Stanford. And they took 15 from UCLA and 15 from USC in the South. And we traveled by train. The 30 was from Berkeley, from San Francisco, went by one train. The 30 from the Southern California went by another train. But we arrived in Lincoln, Nebraska at the same time. And we all got on the same train. So that the 60 boys from California ended at New York Club University at the same time.
That's a long way from Taft, from the oil fields to the Ivy League, in a hurry there. What were some of those early training exercises or eye-opening things that you experienced?
Well, first of all, we got there in the winter. We arrived late because the train was snowed in Lincoln, Nebraska. So they had a big celebration because we were the anniversary class 1 year after Pearl Harbor. We were supposed to start December 7th. And all the Navy bigwigs from Washington were there. We missed it all because we got there a day late. So they put us all on and together. There was 1,200 midshipmen. The other 900 were mixed up as they came in, they mixed them. But we ended up together on the 12th floor of the dorm there. And so some of the discipline we weren't used to. The weather we weren't used to, especially from California. One of my friends there was from Massachusetts, and he used to tell me, be sure to keep your face covered, your lungs will freeze.
And you fell for that one, huh?
I fell for that one, especially when they would have a fire drill at the middle of the night. We'd have to run down 12 flights of stairs and stand at attention in the cold in our shorts until we were dismissed and run back up 12. They wouldn't let us use the elevator, so we had to run back up 12 flights of stairs.
Sounds like you were ready to move on to a warmer climate, huh?
Yeah, the standing watch was pretty tough in those days, especially if it was outside. Inside wasn't so bad, but outside was pretty rough.
Well, and we've got a lot to talk about overseas because you have very vivid stories in this book from some of the major battles in the Pacific. But there was a very significant event that happened before you ever went overseas. And I don't know if you knew how significant it was going to be at the time. But tell me how your life was changed by one of your next stops stateside before you went overseas.
We were sent from New York, from Columbia University. We were given orders, which we were not to look at till we got away from the university. And my orders sent me to Virginia Beach, Virginia, to amphibious training. And probably the most dramatic event was when I was training troops in the landing boats, and we trained on the beach at Chesapeake Bay. And they had big signs, Kaiser signs, at each end of the landing beach. On one side it said, no personnel beyond this point. On the other side it said, no naval personnel beyond this point. So I was running landing boats into the beach, and one of my boats veered off and started an erratic trip to the beach. So I followed, finding what was going on. As I got closer, I noticed three girls on a blanket just on the civilian side of the sign. My sailors were trying to chase these crabs, which they have back there, sort of walk sideways. They were trying to get these crabs to go up towards these girls' blanket, and they were screaming and jumping up and down. So I, as their officer, commanding officer, had to get off and tell them to get back on their side of the beach, naturally.
Yeah, you had to get off and get them under control. You couldn't sneak a peek at the sunbathing girls or anything.
So one of the girls asked me what I did in my spare time, and I told her I stayed on the base. She said, don't you ever date? I said, well, there's about a million guys for every girl in it, so there's no point in it. She said, well, Virginia has a couple of sisters up in it. You could get a date. Well, Virginia was Peggy's sister. And she said, my husband's jealous. I'm not going to do anything. So the other girl said, well, I'll take care of that. I'll call. You give me your phone number. So she did. She called me and told me that she had a date with Margaret. So I called Margaret, and she said she wouldn't go with me unless she brought her girlfriend. I had to bring another guy. So we double dated, and that was the beginning of 68 years of romance.
So let me get this straight. You agreed to the date. You'd never met her, seen her, had no idea what she... You just knew her sister was pretty good looking.
That's right. That's correct. You can go by that.
So then you go to pick her up, and she didn't say, hey, wait a second, this isn't the guy I want to go out with.
No, we got along very, very nicely. We went to the Monticello Hotel and danced in the Starlight Room of the Monticello Hotel. We had a great time. It was... It was a fun time. So for the next 2 or 3 months, I was there about 3 months, we dated.
When you moved on, did you think you were ever going to see her again?
No, I probably didn't think I would see her again, because I figured I probably would not come back to that port again, you know. And I had no idea how long the war would last, so.
So what'd you tell her before you left?
I can't remember. You'll have to ask her.
You can't remember either right now? All right. But you guys wrote letters for a while, huh?
She wrote to me every week, and I was overseas for 28 months. So I have a lot of letters, and we really got to know each other. But I did come back one time for advanced amphibious training. They sent me to Port Pierce, Florida. And when that was over, they had a new amphibious ship coming off of the ways in Portsmouth, Virginia. So they sent us back there. And we dated a couple of times before our ship was ordered out to sea.
And you talk about all this amphibious training, and we've had a lot of guys on the program that had a variety of roles in a lot of those different landing craft. Was this kind of a big adventure for you, getting to understand and learn how to use these different machines and ships?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot to learn, like I say, coming from the deserts of California to the ocean was a big change. But it was fun. When you're young, you adapt quickly. And I met some great guys, and it was a great experience, an adventure.
You remember what it was like to head overseas? Because obviously you joined the Navy, you knew this was coming at some point. When that time actually came, what do you think your outlook was?
Well, I think we were, you know, you're trained up to this. And training is so important. So we were anxious to get started. We were anxious to make a landing. We were anxious to use the skills that we had been taught. So when our ship left Portsmouth, Virginia, and went through the Panama Canal, landed in San Diego. Camp Pendleton is right near San Diego. So we picked up the 4th Marine Division with a flotilla of amphibious ships and took them to San Clemente, and they practiced the landing there. We brought them back to San Diego and took them back a second time to San Clemente after we worked out a lot of the flaws. And the third time we picked them up, we were gone from the Marines having liberty and partying on Saturday night. The next thing you know, they were landing on the enemy beach.
Yeah, isn't that a striking contrast? But you had a bit of a scare before you got to ship out even. And I imagine there are a lot of sailors, maybe some even listening today, who have woken up from a bad dream in which somehow his ship left without him. For you, that wasn't a dream. We're going to get to that story when we come back. We'll also hear the story of why you volunteered for dangerous middle-of-the-night duty, taking men in before the start of an island invasion. Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California, our guest today. Hard to believe he's 93 years old when you listen to him, isn't it? If you want to see what he looked like back then and what he looks like now, check out the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll also find instructions there on how to get your hands on his terrific book, The Gator Navy, The Amphibious Navy I Knew During World War II. And we'll try to make some more of those pages come alive when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.